the positions of.
So, can you tell me your name and where you were born? Mm-hmm. And the year.
Okay. My name is Yuri Kochiyama, but when I was young, I just used Mary, and my maiden name was Nakahara.
And where were you born and when?
In San Pedro, California.
Can you say, you know, I was born?
Oh, I was born in San Pedro, California.
And what year?
1921. Can I add something? You could take, oh. I just want to say that my mother told me that every single Japanese child that was born in the harbor area, that one Japanese Issei woman brought us all into the world, because no blacks, Mexicans, or Asians could have a baby in a hospital. I mean, there was a lot of racism that we didn't even know about.
And I'm picking up the sound of that. So.
You're picking up what?
Like when you move your hand.
Yeah, give me the tissue.
It's just really sensitive.
Wait a minute. I can't. Because, wait, you mean you get even the.
Like wait, if you crinkle it, it makes a noise.
Okay, wait. Let me just blow my nose right now.
Okay.
Okay.
So you were just talking about the kinds of. Racism, that people of color couldn't be in hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So can you describe, like, before the outbreak of the war, what life was like? Did you feel like you were an American?
I think I did back then. And they didn't have the words Asian American. But our town was very much an immigrant town. Majority were Slavonian and Italian. Everybody was very nice and friendly to one another, helpful. I just went to a reunion, and the people were still as warm and kind. No, I think I was lucky to grow up in San Pedro.
So, it sounded like you had limited employment opportunities. Like, did you find discrimination when you tried to get a job?
Oh, absolutely. But the school world, I never felt any racism. But soon as I finished and I tried to get a job, it was almost impossible. I went to 3 5-and-dimes, they wouldn't take me. Then I went to Woolworth because I saw a Mexican girl there. And so I went over to talk to her because I knew her from school. And she said, oh, I'm the first Mexican. And she said, why don't you try? They might take you. But she said that no Japanese has even tried here. And I was surprised. But they did let me have a job, but it was only for Saturdays and holidays. But I couldn't work a whole, 5 or 6 days.
So how did you feel, if you say that in school you didn't feel racism,
yeah.
How did it feel to suddenly be faced with that kind of racial discrimination?
Well, I think I always thought it was going to be that way because I saw all the other, Asians who graduated before me, they had a hard time getting a job. I mean, the only kind of job you could get, well, a lot of people went to Chinatown in L.A. to get a job, but there was no Chinatown or J-Town, in San Pedro. But outside of, I think, that kind of a racism that no one talks about, it was all against the people of color. Our town, as I said, was majority Italian and Slavonian, but I don't think they experienced what people of color really faced and went through.
So can you describe what happened to your father when Pearl Harbor was bombed?
Well, soon as I guess it came over the radio that Pearl Harbor was being bombed by the Japanese Air Force, my father had just come back from the hospital the day before. He had some surgery done, and he was lying in bed. It was right after I came back from teaching Sunday school, and the only one home was him and I. And then three tall white men came knocking on our door. I couldn't imagine who they were, and they just all showed a little card, and it said Federal Bureau of Investigation. At that time, I didn't even know what that was. And then they asked if Seishi Nakahara lived there, and I said, oh, yes, that's my father. And said, where is he? And I said, he's sick. He's in the back sleeping. They just went right in the house, didn't say another word, woke him up and told him, put on your slippers and bathrobe and come. And everything happened so fast, I didn't have a chance to even ask, where are you taking him? Instead, they didn't say a word, and I didn't, and Pop didn't say a word. And I just called my mother, who was just down the street with my aunt, and said, come home right away. Some white men came and they took Pop, and they had a card that said FBI, so Mom came running home.
And so what happened to him?
Well, he was taken. It took us days to find out where they took him. They took him to the federal prison. There's one in Terminal Island. And then through lawyers, my mother finally got I guess the lawyer went with her and said that she has to see her husband because he's sick and all that. And so I think it was almost every day. No one else could go, but she was able to go and see him.
And then what happened?
Well, he was getting worse. Well, they were interrogating him for hours, and my mother wanted that to stop. And then she even said, you have to get him out of the prison and let him go to the hospital until he's better. Then you could take him back. And so then they said, all right, they are going to. And they put him in the San Pedro Hospital, which became a hospital only for merchant marines who were hit on Wake Island, and they were bringing them to the San Pedro Hospital. And so Mom says she was so shocked. She went to the San Pedro Hospital. It was just one big room, huge room, and beds were all over, and they were all white guys who were injured in Wake Island. And they put my father right in the midst of that with a sheet around the bed and said, prisoner of war. Because when she saw that, she said, he's not going to make it. I mean, you know, he'll be beaten to death, I guess. And so then she got a lawyer and talked to the lawyer. And I don't know, the lawyer, because the lawyer was from San Pedro, lived in San Pedro a long time. And, you know, being a professional, I guess, they would listen to him. And they made a, what do you call it? They made a, what is it? Agreement that until he gets better, he could have a room of his own. And so that's what happened. He got a room of his own.
So do you know why he was called a prisoner of war and what they were interrogating him about?
None of our family saw him. My mother did, and they told her that he's a spy. And she was shocked, said, no, he's not a spy. He said, we've been watching him for about 20 years. And it was true, he was taking, you know, the Japanese steamship people, those officers who wanted to play golf, and he would chauffeur them to the golf courses. There were no military, what do you call it, on the highway then, highway or on the road, to any golf course. Though they said, oh, we had military installations on the road to the golf courses. There wasn't. The reason why we were suspect, I guess there were a lot of reasons. First of all, they did not trust anyone who was in fishing because they knew the Pacific Ocean, and they were afraid that if the Japanese some landed, that maybe these Isseis might shield them or hide them or do something. And so eventually every person over 16 who was in fishing was taken, and they were taken to places like not the regular concentration camps. They were sent to like North Dakota, Montana, and places much worse than the camps we went to.
So they thought because he had relationships with Japanese nationals, he was suspicious?
Well, and especially, I mean, anyone who was in fishing, because they did know the water well.
Were there other reasons why they suspected him of being a spy?
What?
Were there other reasons they suspected him of being a spy?
I don't know. They thought he was a spy, no matter what. They thought he was already a spy. I don't know, maybe he went back to Japan the year before, and he was lucky. He and my mother were on the last boat, also my brother, to get back to America. All those other Niseis, the boat turned around, went back to Japan. And I've heard their stories. Oh, those who had to stay in Japan, then they stayed 7 years, and a lot of them were killed, and some of the young guys had to go into a Japanese military. And, you know, all kind of things happened to those who had to go back to Japan.
Well, your family was immediately affected by the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. When you first heard that that happened, how did you respond when you first heard that Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Well, I think every Japanese was calling up each other to say, did they take your father away yet? Has anyone come around? There were so many curious people that came, and then we found out years later that they had FBI men staying right across the street from us. We never knew until years later, and they were watching. But, I heard that they were watching Pop for a long time, and I think it's because he was taking those Japanese, officers, it was really only to the golf courses, but they thought he was, spying. And then it happened that we have one of those, what do you call it, in front of our house? What do you call it?
Antenna,
more than an antenna. But my father had that built just for looks. It looked artistic, one of those things. And they thought that must be that Pop was, what do you call him, getting
radio.
What?
Radio,
yeah. How do you say it?
Like a transmission?
Yeah, that he was getting messages, I guess, from Japan. But it wasn't so.
Well, did you first learn about the bombing over the radio, or you learned about the bombing from people calling you?
I was in the car. It was on a Sunday morning, and I teach Sunday school every Sunday. And I got to the main street, Pacific, on 11th and Pacific, and I see all these soldiers, sailors, Marines, and they're hitchhiking. I thought, my God, what is going on here? I didn't know anything about Pearl Harbor yet, but I see a classmate of mine, and he's hitchhiking. So I called him over, and I said, what's going on? Can I give you a ride? And he got in the car and said, "Don't you know what's happening right now?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Oh, Japan's bombing Pearl Harbor." And I just couldn't believe it. But I see all of these soldiers and sailors on the street coming into Pacific and all heading towards the fort. They said that they got an alert signal. And so I just dropped him off there. And then I went to the Sunday school. And I never felt so different in my life. All the time for a year that I had been teaching there, I didn't feel strange. They were kids, you know, from the neighborhood. I knew these kids, junior high school kids. But that day, for the first time, I felt, oh, I'm Japanese. That's what. And so everyone felt uncomfortable, I think.
What race were the kids you were teaching?
Oh, they were all white. And I used to take them home, and one by one, we'd pack a car and take home. And everybody was so quiet, I thought the best thing is, let's call it short, you know, no class today. And they were happy. And they said, "Well, can we still go in the car?" And I said, "Of course." So I took all the kids home one by one and came home. And that's when, after I came home, that the three FBI men came.
So can you talk about, did families, you said that people were calling each other to say, did they take your father, did they take your father? Uh-huh. When your mother was fighting to try to get your father into better conditions, were families organizing together who were under the...
Well, I think every Japanese was calling up some other Japanese, but I guess they didn't get around to that many. But in the first 48 hours, I think about 300, I think, were picked up. I didn't know any women were picked up till years after the war. I don't know why, but 6 Japanese Issei women were also picked up. All the rest were men. And most of them were either in fishing or they were, they had a good job within the Japanese community. I mean, they were leaders of the Japanese community, or they taught Japanese, you know, in Japanese school, or they were martial art teachers.
And so what ended up happening with your dad?
What?
What ended up happening to your dad?
Oh, a few weeks later, exactly 6 weeks from the time he was picked up, he was gone. I mean, they brought him home the last 12 hours. A nurse brought him home in an ambulance, and then about not even 12 hours, they brought him home around 6 in the evening, and early in the morning, like 6 or 7, they woke us up and said, "He's gone." And then the FBIs came over and said, "Anyone who comes to the funeral, they're going to be..." What's the word? Watched. What's the word? They'll be... What's a common word?
Under surveillance.
Yeah, they'll be under surveillance. But anyway, we had a regular funeral. I mean, even though there were already laws that passed that said no Japanese can travel more than 5 miles, and then there was a curfew for all of us. But of course, the funeral was during the day, that we wouldn't be breaking any laws. And, well, I mean, the FBI were all there watching the Japanese come in. But even the Hakujin family next door, they came to the funeral. And I thought that was nice because soon as the war ended, all the people in town, and, you know, there weren't many Japanese on the San Pedro side, but they didn't know if they should even talk to us, you know, that if they talked to us, would they be suspect? And so, well, it just, I had started a job at the Five and Dimes at Woolworth, but they felt, they said they couldn't fire me just because I'm Japanese, so they said, we'll just see what's going to happen. And they said, if we have trouble because you're here, you just got to go. And so on that, I mean, they let me stay for all the way to the time that all the Japanese had to leave.
You just talked, I want to ask you how life changed after Pearl Harbor, and you were just talking about the curfew and the limitation mm-hmm. on how far you could drive. How mm-hmm. else did life change for Japanese?
Oh, I think all the Japanese said the same thing, that so many of their white friends, they didn't know what to do either. They didn't know whether they should say hello or not. You know, I mean, there was a, I guess you could call it sort of a war hysteria mixed with racism. And I mean, if we were Hakujin and we saw some Asians and the war was against Asians, I don't know how we would be feeling, you know. So, well, all the Niseis that, you know, talk to each other over the phone, they said, we all just have to be careful and don't do anything, you know, stupid to make it worse for all the Japanese or even for the white people. You know, we had always lived, you know, harmoniously, so, yeah.
Well, it doesn't seem that harmonious if you had trouble getting jobs.
Other than that, I mean, people in San Pedro were nice. San Pedro was, what do you call it, connected with each other through high school sports. Everybody in San Pedro went to high school, whether it's football, basketball, tennis, or what. And through sports, San Pedro was quite a well-knit town.
Okay. Yeah. How did families learn about the relocation process? How did you learn that you were going to have to move?
Oh, by April 1st, there was a schedule, you know. I think we all left on April 1st or 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and then maybe Huntington Park and some others in that area. Then there was a 5-6 day period.
You first learn that April 1st was your move date?
Oh, they had notices, and there were even all kind of things, you know, on the that were put up on, what do you call it? Not billboards. We didn't have billboards, I don't think. But they're put up, you know, outside that everybody would know what's going to be happening.
That must have been so scary, though, to just read on a poster mm-hmm. that you're going to have to move.
Oh, it was on the radio and all, yeah. And there were a lot of Hakujins that I think they did feel bad, but they didn't know what to do. I mean, they don't want to get mixed up in anything and be accused of being too friendly to a Japanese. And we understood that, so we didn't go out of our way to still keep up a conversation or anything with them.
So how did the families prepare? What did the families do when they learned that they were going to have to move?
Well, it was every single day from Pearl Harbor Day, from December 7th, every day. What can we do for the Japs? And it was headline, get the Japs out, get the Japs out. And we knew that California, Oregon, and Washington, and parts of Arizona were in the what you call combat zone for the West Coast. So any Japanese or part Japanese even, if they were living in that area, they would be, what do you call, uprooted and evacuated.
So, people accepted it? They knew that it was going to happen? And
oh, yeah. I mean, I feel bad. Terminal Island had the best Japanese dolls and stuff because they used to have, you know, matsuri or something like that. It's stupid. They threw all the family heirlooms into the ocean And if any of them had guns or anything, boy, that went, swords went. I mean, anything Japanese. But I don't know, my family said, no, we don't want to throw these things away. It's from the family. And so they said they're going to keep the yoroi, the armor, Japanese armor we had in the living room, that we're not going to get rid of, that we're going to just, and hope that the whoever stays here will take care of these things. But they went to every Japanese home, I think, and said, is there anything you want to have stored? Because it may be safer to have it stored. And so I think things like yoroi and swords and things, I don't know, somebody must have packed them. Maybe it was neighbors. And I think it was they kept them in the police department.
So, did people know where they were going to go? Did they know how much they could pack?
No, it was only what you could carry. And so, of course, the parents of each family tell them, don't bring anything unnecessary. And we just could not carry anything that could be used as a weapon. I mean, no knives. I don't think they let us bring chopsticks, no radio, no. I mean, the only thing we knew that we should bring would be light clothes. They let us take spoons, I think. Well, I know they didn't let us take other things, like no knives, forks, or weapons, I mean, hashis. And we knew that bedding's important, so we all carried some beddings. And they said, well, what you can carry. But all these young mothers who had babies, gee, they had all those bottles and diapers and stuff like that to carry, that they couldn't bring much besides the baby stuff. But we were at just the best age, because here I was 20, my twin brother 20, my brother, older brother 23. It was the easiest for our age. But there were families with kids 3 years, 5 years, 6 years old. Oh, and so many young, young women who had just had babies. And so they had all the baby paraphernalia and all.
Well, it sounds like you were an all-American girl.
Yes,
you know,
I was.
You were teaching Sunday school, and you had a job. So how did it feel for you to be packing, knowing that you were being relocated based on your race? Like, what were you feeling while you were getting ready to move?
Well, the Japanese have the word shikataganai. Wait, is that the way you say it? It can't be helped. And I mean, that's about the only thing you could feel. But I only had one incident I was putting up flyers about a alumni dance, San Pedro High School alumni dance, and all the flyers are sort of on cardboard. They're all different color, and I was putting them up for about an hour. Nothing happened to me. No one even questioned anything until I went to this hamburger hut. And it was a nice place where a lot of high school kids hang out. And there was a cop sitting on a, and when he saw, those, it's more than leaflets. I mean, they're heavier than a leaflet. But when they saw me come in with those, and they were all different colored, this guy, he was a lieutenant, he says, I think we've got to be careful. And everybody stopped talking and everything. And then he called me to the side, and I thought I had hoped somebody might speak up and say, oh, I know she's okay. You don't have to. No, and they were so scared. They were kids I knew well, and, were going to high school and all that. But nobody said a word except the one and only person I didn't know at all. and he was the cook there. And he just said, I don't see anything wrong with this. It's just to advertise an alumni dance. And then the cop took me outside and he said, you're going straight down to the police station. And I had a car. I was driving then. He said that I trust you now, or we could find out where you live and all. He said, just go to the police station and we'll meet you down there. I was scared. I said, okay. You know, what could I say, you know? And then when I got back in the car, I was thinking, gee, I wish I could bring a friend with me. I didn't want to go down there by myself. And I went to several friends' houses. Guys were on the football team who I thought, oh, they'll go with me. But every time I got there, well, they're all living with their families. And I thought, oh, their family's not going to like that. So then I decided I better go by myself so I don't get anyone else in trouble. And I went to the police station. But the sergeant at the desk, he said, I bring those cards. And so I gave it to him. He looked at it. He said, I don't see anything wrong. He was good. And those cops who told me to be down here, when they came in, the sergeant just said, why you tell her to come down? There's nothing wrong with her carrying these. And so, I mean, I went. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't want my family to worry about anything. But that was the only thing I went through.
Is there anything that you had to leave behind that you regret when you were relocated? Was there anything you couldn't take with you?
No. If something happened to our dog about that time, I would want to take that dog with me. I don't know what happened, but something gave in the right below our house, something caved in, and the dog fell in, and we couldn't, it was awful, because here we were almost leaving and packing, and then this happens to our dog, Teddy, that we loved. I mean, he always went everywhere with me, but I don't know what happened. But every Japanese who had a pet, that was one of their big, what are they going to do with their pet? My cousin lived just down the, you know, down the alley, and what they told him, he couldn't take it. So the neighbors were nice, so they said, any of the pets will feed. And I think many Japanese who are living in the San Pedro side, some neighbor must have taken pets, you know. And we don't know what happened to them. Teddy was gone, of course. And my cousin's dog, when he came, he couldn't wait to see his dog. He was like blind. And he said it'd be more merciful to, you know, have him just go. So he took him somewhere, and I don't know, the dog. So, but then it was so pathetic. And the neighbors said, well, we all took turns feeding him, you know, that people, you know, there's a book coming out now. There's a project called, what's the name of it? There's a Japanese woman who's putting a book together. She's calling everybody saying, do you remember anyone that was not Japanese? They could be anything, black, white, brown, who helped the Japanese during the war when most people would stay away, you know, from that kind of thing. And what's her name? Her first name is Japanese. Her second name is Siegel. Yeah, well... And this, it's Kamiya? Called, what?
Kamiya?
No, Kansha Project, I think. Yeah. And I know we've given her about four good stories. What?
Like the neighbors who helped the pets.
Yeah. Or more specific things like Mr. Finch, what, you know, he became the father of the 442 or godfather of the 442. I mean, he used to get candy for the kids in camp, you know, during Easter. I mean, and He went to every hospital to see how the Japanese who were injured were getting along, you know, if they're getting good treatment. I mean, and any, all those who became blind, he got blind dogs for them. And he made sure that all the amputees were getting good, what do you call those things?
Prostheses.
Yeah, prostheses and all. I mean, there are all kinds of people who did things, yeah.
Do you want to take a break and drink some water?
Yeah.
So, can you describe what the camps were like? Like, what did they smell like and what did they feel like?
Well, the camps weren't made yet, and so we were all put in either in a racetrack or a, what's the other word? Racetrack. Fairgrounds. Okay. Should I say that over?
Yeah, hold on.
Okay. All the people were put in either a racetrack or fairgrounds. So it means that most of us in the 7 months stayed in, what do you call, horse stalls. And they had it all organized that because there's big families and small families, but I think every unit, there should be four people. If you have three people, they're not going to put one more in. But so there was, well, at least some privacy, you know, that families have privacy.
Like horse stalls, like with hay? And
well, then you they give you a Muslim bag, and then they point out, go over there where there's a lot of hay, and you just stick the hay in the Muslim bag, and that becomes your, what do you call it, mattress. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people got sick. I don't know, well, especially Issei's. Maybe the smell, well, not the smell of the hay as much as the smell of the horse. I mean, you could smell the horse, you know, in the stall, because they've been there so long, I guess. But I was very healthy then, 20 years old, and Art, though he's not in good health, but he did well in camp, better than when we were outside. Well, I don't even remember him getting asthma.
When you moved from the temporary spots at the horse stalls, what camp did you move to, and what did like when you got there?
At the end of 7 months, in October, every one of those assembly centers, I don't know, there were about 20, I guess, they sent all the people to a regular, what they call relocation center, which we called concentration camps, and they were in about 8 different states. You know, there were 2 in California, Tula Lake and Manzanar, and then other places would be like Arkansas, Idaho, Arizona, you know, I mean, Colorado, well, anyway, Wyoming.
And what kind of places were they?
They were all desert place. We were in the swamplands in Arkansas. Wyoming was mountains, but I think most of them were deserts or look like deserts. And those who went to those kind of camps, the number that came out with, what do you call it, problem? What do you call it?
Asthma.
What, asthma?
Asthma?
No, not just, but lung problems. Oh, I think
well, so when you first got, it's Jerome, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you first got to Jerome, what did you see? What was it like?
Oh, we were surrounded by forests. And on the other side, not that close, but there was tracks, train tracks. Well, we called it a swampland. When it rained, oh my God, you know, that red mud, you know. But I think we were better than in most places. I hear the worst places were deserts. And so many of those people, after they got our camp, they went into what do you call it? Like Michi Weglin, she was in Gila River, and she had lung problem all the way, you know, through the years till she died. But it's so strange that Art was really good. We thought he would have problems, but he didn't, yeah.
Well, with families taking only what they could carry,
yes.
and then ending up in these places that they, you know, environments like uh-huh. a desert or a mountain, how did the families adapt? How did they
make it? I tell you, the Japanese, I was amazed how after a few months, if you ever went into, we didn't do anything to make it look nice, but those who do a little carpentry or something, I don't know where they got the wood, because most of us, we didn't have wood. We just used carton boxes, a couple of carton boxes make a table, one carton box is a chair. But there were Japanese that made beautiful furnitures, and they, before they left after 7 months, they had flowers growing in front of their barracks. I mean, I was amazed. And the Issei women, because they didn't like that, you know, the way it was when we go to the, what they, we call the black house, where you could go for either a bath or to go to the bathroom. There's no, what do you call it, curtain. And so the Issei women especially, just, they'd even hold it and not go until night, I think, because they said they didn't want to go like that, or they'd have to have somebody, you know, stay in front of them so that no one would be looking. And then the thing is, what was bad was they hadn't finished, you know, the insides of these black houses and stuff. And the workers were there, white workers. And like, well, we were in Arkansas, so these Arkies, and so no Japanese person would want to go poo-poo or what, you know, when, unless they got out of there. And, oh yeah, I think Japanese are very careful about, what's the word, we're very,
not, modest.
Yeah, modest, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the Issei women, you know, we could send out for things like, you could either do Sears and Roebuck or Montgomery Wards. Those were the two places that I guess all the Japanese Americans used. And they would send for just material, because those Montgomery Wards thing, you know, they have a picture on each page. You know what you're getting. And the Isseis put a curtain, you know, at each, what do you call it, urinal place, you know, where you're, and they put also curtains, you know, where you take a bath. And, I mean, after that was, and that was done in a short while, maybe the first month, that, you know, people didn't feel funny going to the bathroom. But I know at the beginning, even the little kids said they didn't like to go because other people are watching you, and especially everything is line up for this and line up for that. And, you know, you can't really feel comfortable when you know there's a line starting right in front of you, you know. And so I thought that was wonderful that the Isseis did that.
Can you talk about your letter writing, the Crusaders that you did? So can you just describe what the Crusaders were?
Well, I had a Sunday school. It started off with only 5 kids. They were about 14, 15 years old. And by coincidence, each one had a brother in service, and so did I. So one of the kids, the girls, said, well, I had told them that we got to do something, you know, a service to the community. We can't just do nothing. There's a lot of things we could do. And then one of the girls said, let's write to the Nisei soldiers. And I thought, what a great idea. And so then I said, well, we got 5 soldiers' names. Could you all, by next Sunday, bring a couple more names. I said, maybe somebody else in your barrack has a son or father or brother. And so then they came back. Each one came back with at least one name. All right. And then every week they were bringing back some name. And they got really into it. And they went through their whole barrack, you know. And the people were so nice. Oh, they said, sure. And they gave us their son's name, their husband's name, father's name. And we were getting within, I don't know, before we left Assembly Center, we had, I think, a couple hundred names. And the families were so happy because they said, we want to be sure somebody sends letters to them. And then I know people won't believe it when we say, well, we got Issei's interested. My mother got so interested. She even did the recording, you know. So, you know, who wrote to this guy? Who wrote, you know, so that everybody would be covered.
So, What were the soldiers writing back to you? Like, if they know that you're in the Assembly Center, so were they experiencing?
They were tickled to get these letters, especially from the kids. And we got younger and younger kids, because when the junior high school and high school kids were writing, and I think a lot of them were excited writing to a soldier. They had never written to a soldier before. And then even the grammar school kids, when they would ask us, what are you doing? And they said, oh, we want to do it too. All right. And people would ask us all the time. When, after 2 years, I know people won't believe it, we had 13,000 names. 13,000. Well, in the whole, during the war, 35,000 Japanese men or women served during World War II, but here we had 13,000, which is not quite a third, huh? But, and...
Well, so did the soldiers talk about discrimination? Were they treated...
No, they knew that the kids were young, and you could tell by their... and we sent only postcards, but the postcards were only a penny, can you imagine? So when somebody would... donate a dollar, that means 100 people could get a postcard. And the girls would write out things. We all wrote about the same thing, you know, like, we're thinking of you, it's Thanksgiving Day, hope you'll get to eat a turkey or something. And then the grammar school kids like to draw. And some of them were good. And so they would draw, you know, like people sitting around a table eating. But I wish I had, I mean, it was, everything was so, I think, not the word unique, but new. You know, I mean, nobody had to be an artist. Who cares? You know, if you could even just draw a line, you know, to the guys, it meant something that somebody was thinking of it. And if the kids were too young to address it, you know, the junior high school and high school kids would do the addressing.
Well, did you feel any of the irony that you were in camp and people who were Japanese were serving in this war while you were in camp?
No, you know, it's strange, but I guess a lot of people probably did, but I don't know. I mean, we got so much into it that every day we'd wait for the mailman, you know, to see how many cards from... Well, we sent postcards. They sent regular, maybe just a note in an envelope. And that was only 2 cents in the war. Can you imagine? And today we're paying 37 cents. Although 23 on postcards, but a penny. God.
So it kind of helped pass the time in the camps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And all kind of things were going on in camp. There were, I guess, young boys that were learning. Somebody's teaching karate or, I mean, all kind of things. And even the Isseis were learning to dance and all. And then there are guys who play cards and all. But I think sports was the main thing that, you know, brought us all together. We all go out to watch our block play.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on to the current day. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll flash back a little bit. But where were you when you learned about the World Trade Center getting crashed into?
Oh, so you're getting right up to the moment.
Yeah, and then we'll flash back.
Yeah. That happened in 201, not 200, 2001, September 11th. Wait a minute. So I was out here, and I wasn't in New York. I don't know, maybe you called me, but when it was on the TV, oh, I think several people called and said, put on your TV right away. And before I could say, what's on? You know, I guess they clicked and they were calling someone else. When I saw that, it was almost unbelievable. I mean, how could it happen in the United States? And here, right in New York, and then you worry about, I wonder how close it is to people you know. But it's, I want you to see that book I've been reading again. Yesterday I picked it up. It's here something. I want you to see the pictures. You know, I thought to myself, gosh, here, there must have been a lot of people who happen to have cameras, unless they're tourists in New York, because the pictures that were taken by so many people, I mean, even if you were having a contest of who could take the best, most dramatic pictures, I mean, they just happened to have a camera, and they just shot whatever. But I've never seen such great pictures. And I'm reading a book. I want you all to read it. It's a scientist and a writer. It's their second book on 9/11. Well, they weren't there to take the picture. They were here in California, I think. But they went back to New York to check, and they went, I mean, they interviewed a lot of people, not just those who lived in New York, and to get their sentiment on the whole thing. They interviewed a lot of people who are in like architecture or science, and they got the opinions of a lot of people who are into building these big buildings and things. And
can we see the book after the interview?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
When you saw what was happening, what went through your mind?
Well, the first thing was I called up family people saying, do you know anyone who works there? I wonder how many Japanese were there or Chinese. Well, Chinatown's business went. Just a lot of them couldn't even have a business after that because people were afraid to go down there. It's almost like overnight, like restaurants.
What are the reactions were you having?
Well, I think first, the actual horrendous looking, you know, the smoke and all that and all the... how everything almost went to just dust, huh? And it was like a dark smoke enveloping. The whole thing is amazing that some people got out, though. You wonder, how could they have gotten out? And there were people who told stories that they just ran and ran, you know, just to be ahead of the clouds that were coming after you. But and then you think of those who got stuck, And they were almost out of the building, and someone told them, it's safe, you could go back. And to think all those people were killed because they went back. And then even, you know, stories of firemen where the whole team of firemen, they could have been saved. They didn't have to go back, but they were told to go back, and they were all killed, you know.
On the news when they started saying that it was done by Muslims,
mm-hmm.
Did you feel any kind of, did you relate that to?
No, I never thought it, well, I think because so many of the people that I run around with felt there's something amiss, that there has to be some complicity with the U.S. government. This could not happen without, and why didn't the U.S. government really do anything to save anyone? So many people said they went to the Pentagon and they said it absolutely, at least the Pentagon one, I don't mean the World Trade Centers, the Pentagon, it could not have been one of those huge planes, 747 or whatever, said there was nothing left of a plane, that it had to be a missile. All right, the two that hit the World Trade Center, a lot of people were suspicious, saying that even if you were going to do it and you were training for it, that if you were actually on the pilot seat and you're going towards the target, a human being that usually would, you know, it's not that easy to just go right to the target, even if you're told to go, that you're going to swerve.
Right, so...
Yeah.
You didn't believe that.
Yeah, I couldn't...
But at the same time, you knew that the public was hearing that. So were you worried that there would be backlash?
I went to a lot of meetings where I heard so many speakers. Right? But then there were several things now. They immediately said it was, what's his name, Bin Laden. What's his first name? Osama. Before they knew anything else, they said it was Osama Bin Laden. And U.S. decided that they're going to, the first place they'll bomb is Afghanistan, because they had some proof that Afghanistan was letting Bin Laden stay there, somewhere in the mountains or somewhere. So they said it had to be Bin Laden's group. And sometimes I'm sort of confused, who are the Al-Qaeda and who's the other first group? Bin Laden's group was called something else. What was it?
I think they were Al-Qaeda. I don't know.
Well, now they're saying that they're Al-Qaeda, but there was another group that was first named.
Taliban?
What? Oh. Yeah, Taliban. Taliban, yeah. And I'm wondering, are the Taliban and Al-Qaeda the same?
Well, you know, I saw you speak at the peace vigil in Japantown.
Mm.
It was like maybe a week after the World Trade Center attack.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of Japanese American speakers and Muslim speakers and South Asian speakers. So, can you describe like the important connections that were being made immediately after 9/11?
Okay. Well, the first thing that people saw the flaw was the Pentagon. And also...
Oh, but I mean more yeah, like the political, oh, the community oh. building that was happening. Like, can you talk about that important connection that you were involved in with the Japanese Americans kind of going to support the Middle Eastern and Muslim communities?
Remember when Dina asked you to speak?
Oh, uh-huh. All right. Well... Because I knew a guy that was writing a book and who's pretty thorough. He's a journalist and he's a researcher. And He wrote two books. The first book he gave me, I don't know how he got that book out so fast, almost within a month, with all the pictures and all. And he, because he'd call me all the time to say, here's what I found out. And this whole thing about that was, first of all, why was it that Bush was speaking to a group of grammar school children about a goat or something. And then every single one in the cabinet were not in Washington, D.C.
Well, he ignored them telling him about the bomb. Yeah, the exploding happening.
Yeah. But, you know, they took pictures of Bush when he was right there, and he didn't seem shocked at all.
Well, you know, Yuri, we're not going to get into whether or okay, not 9/11
yeah.
was planned.
Yeah, right.
The thing that we're looking at is the way that the U.S. has...
There's, I think, a lot of similarities.
So did that come up for you? Like, did you feel worried for them because you had gone through that experience already?
Well, no, this Twin Tower thing, I think that was much worse than... Well, have you seen the shots at the Pearl Harbor bombing? Which also is, I mean, frightening almost.
But they lost 3,000 soldiers there.
Too. Yeah. Sailors only. Yeah. Hardly any officers. There's too many things, both at Pearl Harbor, and when you think of Vietnam, the U.S. lied outright to say that one of the American boats was, what do you call it, in the Tonkin Bay, was hit in the Tonkin Bay. Totally lied because they felt they had to get into the Vietnam War. It was for resources, but more than that, if Vietnam won, they were afraid that all the other countries would be communist, turn communist.
The domino theory.
What?
The domino theory.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the thing about taking away Japanese people and putting them away, and then the U.S. taking away people who are brown, how did that affect you?
Well, you know, there's been so many books written that for a year before that happened, that 9/11 happened, U.S. was in their inner circle, the power circle, they were discussing, or maybe a couple of years, not just a year, that somehow we've got to start getting the oil first from Afghanistan, then Iraq. Anyway, the U.S. government, there's a lot of books out now, that they had already all kind of plans to get all the Middle East oil, you know, and yet they never talked about all the oil right here in the U.S., in all these 50 states, 48 states, and Alaska with all its oil, that they felt they had to get over there, U.S.
Oh. I know that you and Bill were involved with the redress movement, mm-hmm. and I wonder if you think that the lessons that society, both the government and the public, learn from the redress movement had any influence on the way policy was made after 9/11.
I think there's a lot of differences. During World War II, let's see, the president was FDR, and then he died, I think, in office, and what's his name, Truman, took his place. Well, I think, I don't care what president, their policies aren't so different. I mean, America is about military power. And I think during World War II, America was wondering how could they knock out Japan. You, U.S. has always wondered whether it was going to war against China first or Japan. But in the end, they felt that China would be a better ally than Japan. And so one of the things U.S. did then was she was helping China get oil and stuff. Japan wanted oil more than anything else, and because it had a standing army that wasn't doing anything. And so then Japan was getting so mad at the U.S. that said, if we don't get oil soon, we're going to have to, I think, war against U.S. Right. This is what, what's his name? Who's the guy that used to go to your place all the time with Bill, Eddie?
Yeah. Morizumi?
No, who you from Japan, who hung out with
Atsushi.
Yeah, Atsushi. I didn't know till like last year. He told me, he said, you don't know why Japan was so mad at U.S.? I said, no, I didn't. I thought it was sort of stupid of Japan to fight against the U.S., a big military might like U.S. I said, Japan was furious with the U.S. Because U.S. is the only country powerful enough to, what's the word, have embargoes or sanctions or all. And Japan felt it was better to fight U.S. than to lose faith. So,
so with all of the political knowledge that you have about U.S. imperialism, why was it important for you? Like, what were you feeling? And why was it important for you to come out and speak right after 9/11?
Oh, I felt we got to, because U.S. history has been constantly.
Can you say that? Because, like, I'm not going to have my question in there, so can you say?
What was the question?
Why was it important for you to come out and speak after 9/11?
Oh, the reason I felt it was important to speak out right away is because U.S. has been doing the same thing over and over. When you think of right from the beginning of U.S. history, first she annihilated the indigenous misnomered American Indians. Can you imagine how many Indians were killed across a huge landscape? And while that was going on, and Europeans were coming here, you know, within 200 years, all the Indian nations were gone. I mean, there were millions of Indians here, but here they were gone, and yet already America was part of the slave trade. And to think that they could have the slave trade, which is also a very, very military kind of thing, you know, capturing human beings and all that, they could do it almost simultaneously. This country, you know, at the beginning that it was a military, what would you call it? That was their main thing. Of building a military, what do you call it here? And that's what they did.
And how does that relate to today?
U.S. is more than, what do you call it? It feels more than ever that U.S. has to control the world now. And if they don't go for it now, it's going to be too late. U.S. probably has the best, people who study history and all. And U.S. is really way ahead of everybody in going backward to see how there could have been such a power like Rome. And, you know, then afterwards where the British took over the whole world and all. And U.S. has been thinking all in the last 60 years that she's got to get it by, she had hoped, I think, by 2000 that there would be no one who could compete against her. And I think she's been timing it well.
Do you think that How do you feel about, were you surprised when they started incarcerating innocent Muslim people?
No. U.S. always does that. Well, U.S. actually, look what they did to the Indians. It was like putting them into camp. And the slaves were in, slaves worked in
plantations,
you know, because when you do that kind of thing, putting people disempowering them, it is that they really felt, I think, Americans, and a lot of people who wrote way, way back there have written. You don't get it in the history books, but they felt that, oh, this is a good thing that's happening right now. We're helping the Africans so that they could someday become civilized like us and do some of the things that we're doing, but they don't even know anything about science and math. When science and math and medicine first started in Africa, and the Romans and Greeks were going to Africa to learn, you know?
I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm sorry. Adi said that you were involved with organizing Day of Remembrances,
mm-hmm.
and I know that you and Bill were both involved with the redress. So why do you feel it was important to keep the education about the violation of civil liberties with the internment camps? Why was that important for you to
organize? First of all, we never thought, I don't think at the beginning, that we were going to go after reparation. But we thought how sad if our sonses didn't know anything of what the nieces went through, you know, being uprooted, evacuated, incarcerated in mid-U.S. all over. And so that was the reason. But in a short while when we started, I think 1970s was the first one.
The first what?
First Day of Remembrance. And now they even have it, I was so surprised, in Hawaii. But of course there were 1,000 Japanese from Hawaii who were sent right to the camp that we were in, Jerome. And now they're having, because a lot of Hawaiians didn't know. In fact, the Hawaiians in 442 didn't know. And the reason that the officers in 442 thought it would be a good idea for the Kotongs and the Buddhists to get together, go to camp together, was because the Hawaiians didn't know anything of what Nisei families were going through. And it's a good thing they started before they started going overseas, because the Hawaiians have told us many times, we didn't know Nisei's, mainlanders, Kotongs were going through this. Hawaiians, because they're sort of tough-looking guys in the way they talk, they used to think that the mainlanders just wanted to act like Haoles and talk like Haoles. And then the mainlanders used to think, oh, those rugged islanders, they can't even speak English. And they didn't get along. But when the Hawaii boys started coming, they started to talk to the Nisei or Issei people in camp. Gee, we didn't know you were going through this.
Well, why is it important for us to remember, to learn about what the Isseis went through?
Oh, and just for unity. There's nothing as powerful as unity. What if the Hawaii and Nisei guys were still had a lot of what do you call this, about each other, and go to war? Oh, no. I mean, everybody said the best thing that happened was that the Kotongs and the Buddha heads became very close when they went overseas. And then when the number of casualties was always almost even, the same number of Hawaiians died, same number of mainlanders died, and where they could, what do you call it, understand what they're going to. Of course, people were in different kind of outfits. The infantrymen always got hit the most. I mean, more than the engineers or There were several. They even had the band separate, and they had except that the medics, they had a medical group which all learned war, what is it, battlefield medics, and then they would send so many to every company. So every company had the same number of medics, you know.
Well, what do you think was the hardest thing for the Issei's with the internment camps?
Oh, I think more, I just think the hardest would be with their sons who volunteered be killed. I mean, Issei has lost a lot, but I mean, I think losing a member of your family is much worse than, okay, Issei's lost their homes, they lost their whatever field of work they were in.
Can you say that again, that Issei's lost their homes?
Issei's lost their homes, they lost their work, their income, they lost the familiarity of the areas they came from. They lost their, what do you call, civil rights, their all their rights. What do you call?
Self-determination.
Yeah, what? Self-determination? Yeah, everything. I mean, self-determination, civil rights, their, everything. You got to ask that over again. That one, because that's important, because they lost really everything.
Well, what do you think that we have to learn from today with what Middle Easterners are going through? What can we learn from what the Japanese went through?
Actually, the Japanese were not the only ones who went through it. And U.S. keeps its eye out on everywhere. And the thing is,
3 minutes left of tape.
I see. But two, you know, the Japanese have to remember what they did in China, especially the Nanking Massacre, which was where more Chinese were killed. I think they said 300,000 to 500,000, which would be 500,000.
And right, but we're looking at, like, the immigrants, so the people here in America. Do you think Middle Easterners and Muslim immigrants, South Asian immigrants, can learn from the lessons
how can we help them? How can you help them?
Okay, how can Japanese or Asians could help from what they've got?
From they've lost their civil liberties, how can you help them get organized to get their guys out? How can you help them?
You know, actually, it's going to be difficult because U.S. is several steps ahead of everybody. U.S. knew they had to put out a Patriot Act so that they could do everything from, what do you call it, what do you call it when you listen to... phone calls.
Or wiretap.
Yeah, wiretapping and all those things that is going to happen to them. And these immigrants from wherever, if they learn even a little bit of American history, they will see what happened to immigrants before them. And why is it where people from all over the world have come here, and yet why is that all the positions of power are still in the hands of whites, that they know the history of, I mean, Arabs against whites, you know, I mean, the British were all over.
How can they empower themselves if they learn from art, from history?
They've got to be united. That's the first thing. They've got to be united, but
united,
this is a big country.
United with who?
First, their own. You know, that's how blacks always say, before we make alliances or anything, we've got to unite with our own. And I mean, well, It's too bad, but most immigrants, when they come here, they know nothing about what happened to the blacks before them. They know nothing about the indigenous. The indigenous, before so many whites were here, they felt it was important to be united. And they're what Americans call tribes, they call nations. And they had a certain way of how they lived that's really different from whites. One was they placed the women in a different position. Many of the Indian tribes, they're almost led by women.
So are you saying that we should, what should we do now, though?
Oh, yeah, no, now.
Now, what should we do now to help, you know, release some of these people?
But look at the Japanese Americans certainly had a tough time because here they're making, well, first from 1882 when this Chinese Exclusion Act.
But what do you think the...
And then right after that, then they had one law after another, you know, where Japanese could not own land, you know, all of those, Asians could not become citizens. This country had all those things set up that immigrants would not be able to have power. And so I don't think immigrants, since the Patriot Act, and because U.S. is doing so many terrible things all over the world, there is not a place in the world that there are not some American military, what do you call it, ships or bases or what. I mean, U.S. has it all wrapped up. That's why...
So should we just give up?
What?
Shall we just
no,
give
you
up?
Never give up.
Okay, so if no, we. Give up, what do we do?
What do we do? We yeah. gotta. We got to actually have a revolution. Yes, I mean it seriously. We have to do slowly. And there are a lot of people who are serious about it. That it's got to start all over, not just in this country. There are enough people all over the world who are as mad at U.S. as third world people are. We know that U.S. and Europe will stay together. But as for all the other people in this world, they all have good reasons to want to be U.S. And I think it really has to happen. So if it doesn't happen in this century... No, I think it's going to happen in this century.
So, but what can we do? If you really think there should be a revolution...
No, there's a lot of things you could do. First, we're going to stop the draft and tell every young people, don't go to war for the U.S. who are just killing and devastating other countries and people. And look, you know, everything isn't in the paper, especially U.S. paper. Look at these guys who were supposed to come back. They're not even letting them come back anymore. They're so afraid that they won't go back since the Mejia case. If we could get a large percent, first it could be a small percent because people don't want to be the ones to start it. But when soldiers see that they're not going to be the only ones who are going to go AWOL and stuff, and in fact, how did this war, especially with Iraq, begin? I mean, people will never forget. It was a low-ranked, no, he was sergeant, a black sergeant. Before he even went into war, what did he do? He got three grenades, and he threw it in three different tents where the officers were. You know, I mean, it's too bad that that didn't give some kind of a, what do you call it, message to people that this is, that I really admire that guy.
I'm going to stop recording, but do you know what happened?